record, and
we'll start in to get it today. I suspect a lot of what I did on the board is got recorded. It kind of beeped as I was going through the 7 infra orders, and so I'll just repeat those again. Anycocephalomorpha, the Dipsochoromorpha, Nepomorpha, Geromorpha, Leptopodomorpha, Simicomorpha, and Pentamomorpha. And like I said, there's been some people, some workers, thinking that the aratids are different enough that they're right now, the aratids are in the Pentamomorpha, but they are talking about separating them out into their own infraorder, but it hasn't been accepted very well. The Anycocephalomorpha and Dipsochoromorpha, like I said, they're kind of small families, not commonly collected. They're terrestrial. The Nepomorpha includes all the aquatic groups, so it would be like the old Hydrocharizae. The Geromorpha are the things that occur like on the water surface around aquatic areas, but not actually under the water. And so that'd be the Amphibochoraceae. The Leptopodomorpha has only got a couple families. They're kind of around aquatic areas too. It's kind of like the connecting link between the aquatic groups and the terrestrial groups. And then Simicomorpha and the Pentamomorpha are terrestrial. Kind of would be the old Geocharizae. So in a nutshell, that's the higher classification. Now, like I said, what I'll do is spend some time going through some of the characters that come up when we deal with the history. And so now we'll go to the overheads. Guess I should have started out again by reminding that Tuesday is the exam through the orthopteroids. I haven't heard from Ryan yet, so I don't know what's going on there. But and did anybody have any questions on the Hemiptera that we did the other day? We didn't get too far yet, so. Okay, well, some of the characters. As I've already mentioned, the antennae in the terrestrial groups are relatively long and conspicuous. They can be 4 or 5 segmented, whereas the antennae of some of the aquatic groups are small and concealed underneath the head, and so you don't see those as much. The way I'll do these characters is kind of go through some of the parts of the head first, then the thorax, and then the abdomen. So kind of go down. But on the head, most of the time the antennae are kind of filiform in shape, long slender segments. Occasionally the last segment will be expanded a little bit, so that would be what would be called clavate. And some of them, like when we get to the Buridae, are spindle shape. What they mean by spindle is almost more like a football shape. The segment will be kind of shaped like a football. Eyes, the compound eyes are almost always present, fairly conspicuous. Ocelli may or may not be present. We'll use that some to identify some of the families. For example, most of the plant bugs, the Myridae, do not have ocelli. There's some exceptions, but whereas a related family, the Anthochoridae, they do have ocelli. So it's one of the ways you can tell the two families apart. Interestingly, this also is very common, is that there's some individuals that have ocelli and some don't, and it may be whether they've got fully developed wings or brachypterous wings. The brachypterous wings, which you think they might not be able to fly, do not have ocelli, where the wing forms do have ocelli. So the mouth parts have evolved in these long tube-like structure. for sucking. They can suck plant juices, or they can suck, some of them are predatory. What has happened is that the two maxillary mouth parts and the two mandibular mouth parts have become long, slender, needle-like stylets, whereas the labium has become kind of a larger tube-like structure. And so those four stylets, the two from the maxillae and the two from the mandibles, lie in a little groove on the underneath side of the labium. At the base of the beak, the labrum still covers the other part of the bottom part of it. So here you'll have the labrum, just real short here. What you see then, I marked there in red, what you see mostly when you look at the beak is just the labium. And the labium usually is three or four segments. Again, that'll be important in some identification of some families, whether it's the three-segmented labium or four-segmented labium. So you can see the labrum at the base sometimes, and then what mostly you see is the labium, the three or four segments, and then the maxillary and mandibular stylets. They're, again, long, slender, needle-like things. And they would be, if this thing was rotated in normal position, it would just be they'd be laying in a groove in this bottom part. So again, here's just the base, but this went on out, they'd be in a groove on the underneath side. Now what happens when these things feed, the labium doesn't go into whatever they're feeding on. If I'm never very good at drawing this, but say this is a stem of a plant, and the hemipteran, before it starts feeding, will be in this position, and the beak will be right here. It'll put it up against there. There'll be the several segments. Then what happens when it goes to feed, its head will come down. The labium actually bends out like an accordion. It goes like this. And the stylets, I should have color-coded it. Anyway, the stylets continue to go straight down and actually are pushed into the plant or the animal that they're feeding on. So that large beak-like structure doesn't actually penetrate the plant or the animal. Now those maxillary and mandibular stylets that go in, they actually all hook together and form then they have a channel in the middle of it, or maybe a couple channels. They'll have two channels. One's a salivary channel that it can pump saliva into whatever they're feeding on, and then there'll be a food channel where they can suck up the juices that were in that plant or animal. Now what's interesting is those stylets are not real rigid. They're pretty flexible. And so once they get into whatever they're feeding on, they can whip it around inside. In plant feeders, a lot of times you'll see they'll have these plant cells and stuff, and you'll see them wind their way around the cells, not actually penetrate the cells and get to the phloem or the xylem where they can feed. Predatory ones, when they get it inside there, they can whip it all around. It's almost like a mixer macerating the tissue inside, liquefying it, and then it can suck it up. One of an ESA meeting way back when I was a student showed a predatory, I think it was a regivid, feeding on a caterpillar. And it was a caterpillar that had kind of translucent skin, so you could kind of see through up to the inside. And you could see these stylets just whipping around inside, and just, like I said, almost blending the tissues inside, and liquefying it so they could. So anyway, that's how it all works in the mouth parts. They've got these, the labium's what you see, the two, well, there'd be four stylets, the two maxillary and mandibular stylets that can, I believe it's the actual food and salivary channels are in the two maxillary stylets. And when they go to feed, the labium kind of folds up on itself, and just the stylets are inserted in, and they're flexible enough that they can go around cells and into the intracellular spaces and get to the phloem or xylem, or they can whip up the tissue if they're predatory. So
So the silencer are set against the labium within a groove, correct?
They're in a groove in the ventral surface of the labium.
Okay. So they're a little more flexible. Labium flexes, stylus pierce, and then sort of whips around and blends inside.
Or they, yeah, wind around until they get plant tissue. You know, a lot of times they wind around in the intracellular spaces to get to a phloem or xylem to feed. And the predatory ones, they get it inside and they whip it around. And almost sounds like a horror movie to be made again, doesn't it?
Well, you thought being attacked by Jason was scary.
Yeah.
I guess just so I'm clear, the maxillary pulps are what evolved into the stylets.
Pardon?
The like the mouthpiece that evolved into the stylets are the pulps, correct?
It's just the not necessarily the palps. Sometimes in some of these groups, you may even still, not Hemiptera, I can't remember, but some other sucking insects, you may even still be able to find the palps. Like it's not piercing sucking like these are, but like in the butterflies, that siphon-like mouth parts, you can still see palps at the bottom. So it's just the maxilla and the mandibles themselves have become long, slender, have evolved that way. So I already, last time, just to get things started, I mentioned the buculae. And you correctly figured out that they are ridges on each side of the beak, or on the underneath side of the head where the beak comes out. There's usually often a ridge on both sides, and that's what a buculae is. The two of them together, the one on each side, would be buculae. As I said, a lot of the Hemiptera have the head divided into three lobes. This isn't very, I'll draw a couple lines to accentuate it. But as I drew on the board the other day too, those three lobes, and you kind of oftentimes call them, I mean, sometimes what you call these structures is your training that you went through and who you worked with. The stink bug expert that I worked with as a graduate student, Dr. Ralston, he called all these, well, he called the middle one the thallus, and the two lateral lobes he called juga, or singular, so single one would be a jugum. And so that's what I call them, and a lot of people still do, but it seems like the young stink bug workers have now got, so instead of calling this the thallus, they call it the clypeus, which we, you know, other insects, we talk about clypeus, and they talk about these as being the paraclypei. Also, some people call this the juga, the mandibular plates. See, it's labeled on here, actually, mandibular plate. But juga, paraclypei, and mandibular plate are all three names for the same structure, essentially. So the professors that I learned from called it juga, and so I typically call them juga. And so the area on top of the head between the compound eyes is called the vertex. Sometimes you'll see a term called the lora, which would actually be kind of this area below the head, the lorum. I'll bring it up here. Sometimes in the Hemiptera, you'll see the term trichobothria. think I may have mentioned this in an earlier lecture, but those are just hairs that seem to have a sensory function. So they'll have, just because they're kind of sensory hairs. I mentioned here because there are some groups that have trichobothria on the head. It's not as common. More often you see, there's some groups that have trichobothria on the coccyx of the legs. In my group, the stink bugs, there's trichobothria on the abdomen, kind of behind the spiracles. So, moving on to the thorax, the pronotum. When you get out here to the lateral edges of the pronotum, it can be a sharp edge, kind of like you see here. It's a real sharp edge. They call that edged or margined. But sometimes if you're moving across the top of the pronotum and get out there, there's no sharp edge. It just kind of curves around. Mm-hmm. And that's called not margined or rounded. And that may be useful for some identifications too, on whether it's got a ridge or an edge. They even call it reflexed, or sometimes it's really drawn out in a big ridge called explanate. The scutellum, most of the Hemiptera have a more or less triangular shaped scutellum behind the pronotum. In some groups, the scutellum is quite enlarged. When we get to the scutellarity, the scutellum covers almost the entire back. But in most groups, it's smaller and more triangular in shape. Wings, some things you ought to know about the wings. Most of these groups, they are kind of half and half. We'll see some exceptions to that, like the tingeds are kind of more uniformly thickened in that. But usually we have this half and half. The major part of the wing is called the corium. So what I'm drawing in here, and it's labeled right there, is the corium. There's usually this nice suture going down right through here. Mm-hmm. And so then there's still another part of the wing, and that's called, it's got to be labeled on here, that's called the clavus. So the inner, or more mesial, part of the wing next to the scutellum is called the clavus. The larger part of the wing is called the embolium, or called the corium. I'm getting ahead of myself. Already starting to think about the next thing.
Clavus and corium.
Clavus is near the scutellum. The corium is the more larger outer part. A lot of times in the hardened part, there's not too many veins you can see. There's sometimes the main one down the middle that we always talk about is the R plus M, so the radius plus the M goes out. That's what this one here would be. And then a lot of times there's another vein that goes right down along the margin, and it breaks off a little edge part there. That's called the embolium. But that's not as important as a lot of things. One thing that is important is in some families, you'll see, and it's not a vein, it's just a little suture out here. But you go along that outer margin of the wing and you get out towards the tip of that hardened part, and there'll be a little fracture going in, a little suture, and it kind of divides this apical part into a little triangular area. And that's what's called the cuneus. There, it's written there on there. That's what I was asking you the other day, if you knew what a cuneus was. That's what a cuneus is the little triangular tip. Again, the plant bugs, the Myridae, which are really common everywhere, have a cuneus. Anthochoridae, the little minute pirate bugs, have a cuneus. Again, this type of wing is called a hemelytron. Collectively together, they're the hemelytra, again, meaning half wings. I talked about the corium, the clavus, the clavel suture, the cuneus, of course, the apical part that's membranous is called the wing membrane. Again, you should be aware, you know, the difference between a closed wing cell and an open wing cell.
I do. I'm just trying to remember.
Yeah. Closed wing cell is like what you see right here. This is the membranous part, but it's completely enclosed by veins.
Okay.
So it's closed, whereas out here, this is like a wing cell, but it's not completely enclosed. It reaches the wing margin.
Okay.
So this one is open, and this one would be a closed.
So my thought process was actually pretty accurate. Yeah. Where a closed one was actually closed by veins, and an open one is
open.
The veins are just actually
open. Yeah. It's one of those things that actually makes sense. So.
So each wing could have a closed wing cell and open wing cell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some groups only have one or the other. Well, I guess, like, there in the middle there, there's two closed wing cells, and the whole rest of it, I guess, you could call an open wing cell. But so, trying to see, make sure we get everything in the. Again, a lot of groups have fully developed wings, but others will have shortened wings. You know, that's brachypterous. Brachy means short, so brachypterous. And there's some that have individuals that are completely wingless, which would be apterous. I already mentioned the tyngidae. When we get to those, you'll be able to see it, but they've just got a lot of little tiny cells. Lots and lots of little tiny cells, and it's kind of hardened all the way through. We call that reticulate. They'll have a reticulate pattern. Reticulate. Now, that shouldn't be confused with what we see in the bugs, the Aratidae. Instead of having little cells, they've got lots of little bumps. And it kind of gives it a similar look, but that we would call granulate. So reticulate wings have the lots of little cells, and or punctures almost, they almost look like, but little cells, whereas the Aratids have just they're real rough and bumpy. And we'd call that more granulate or granular.
Okay, so reticulate isn't the same as when you have like a lace wing with a net-like wings?
That's the reticulate, is the lace bug. I'm talking about lace bugs. You said lace wings. You're talking about the neuropterins.
Mm-hmm.
That I would call reticulate. Well, they could be considered some of it reticulate. We use reticulate to some of the other orders too. Or at least in some of the other groups, they'll have areas of the wing where it's reticulate. The whole wing may not be reticulate. But yeah, that's reticulate's kind of that lots of little cross cells, cross veins, and forming lots of little roundish cells. As I said, I mentioned in the past, Hemiptera do have mechanisms to hold the two pairs of wings together when they fly. So they beat in synchrony. It's a little bit more highly evolved. The way it works is the hind wings it's almost like a C-shaped device. And in the other wing, there's a ridge or a fold that fits into that C shape. And that C shape, they're made of hard bristles or almost scale-like bristles, but it holds it together. And like I said, there can be some longitudinal movement. Things like the Hymenoptera, it's like Velcro. They actually attach to them. So I almost, like I said, think this is a little bit more evolved in that. So, but near the apex of the clavis, along the anal margin of the front wing, there's a set of opposable ridges. So that C-shaped thing's on the front wing near the apex of the clavis. And then on the hind wing, there's this ridge that fits into those ridges along that costal margin of the front wing. So if you fold these out near the end of the clavis, so in here there'll be this little C-shaped hook-like thing, and it'll fold out, and then the front edge, see, it would be right in here, and these two that are out here, the C-shaped hooking mechanism would be there, and there'd be this ridge in the hind wing going along about right there that fits into it.
And you said it.
That's similar to like Hymenoptera's jugal hooks, kind of.
Well, they've got, and I've got to remember which way it goes, but they've got a series of little hooks in one place, and then they've got a ridge that those hooks fit over. A jugal lobe is more like just having a lobe coming out at this part of the wing that overlaps. This would be more like you'd see in the butterflies, the Lepidoptera, where the lobes overlap the other one and kind of keep them, make them so they'd be. Lepidoptera also will have a thing called a frenulum. Sometimes they've got a little hook with a hair-like bristle that fits into it to help keep them together. So, still on the thorax, scent glands. Many Hemiptera do have scent glands. On the immatures, at least in the stink bugs, they're located on the backs, on the dorsal surface of the abdomen. But in adults, they're usually between the middle and hind legs. They're on the underneath surface. If you look between the middle and hind coccyx, you'll see a little opening. And then often there's a little ridge or some little structure that goes out laterally, a spout or something like that. And they're also, the surface around that spout will have a different look to it. It'll be kind of more matte. Most of the insect may be kind of shiny in that area around the scent gland, and around that scent gland aperture is more of a granulate, roughened. We call it the evaporative area, so, or called an evaporatorium. And it does give off a defensive secretion. It smells bad, tastes bad, helps it with predators and stuff. So, the legs, not too much to say about the legs. They're typical legs, although you'll see lots of modified legs for the habits that they live in. The aquatic groups, a lot of them will have legs modified for swimming, the natatorial legs. The predatory groups, some of them will have their front legs thickened and adapted for grabbing things, so they'll be raptorial legs. But they have the basic leg parts that we see in most insects. One thing that will come up, and we got good pictures of them on the handouts when we get to them, but they'll talk about the claws being either apical or anti-apical. Apical, I mean, it's like what you'd think too. The last, you've got your tarsal segments, and the claws will come out of the very tip of the last tarsal segment. That's apical. Whereas in some families, that last tarsal segment will actually protrude on farther out, and the claws come out underneath here. And so the claws are not clear out at the very apex, and that's what ante means. Ante means before. So their anti-apical would be before the apex claws. Things like the family Veleidae, which you may not know right now, but also the Geridae water striders have anti-apical claws. So we'll get to that. But that's what we mean by that. Sometimes there's structures at the base of the claws. If there's one under each claw, we call those, usually call those povilli. If there's just a single projection between the claws, that often we call that an aerolium. But that's, again, pretty standard. Okay, I think that covers most of the characters that I was going to go over before we get into this. And so now we can start talking about some of the families. And we'll start, probably go, we'll go through them in kind of the order, the info orders that I, the way I put them up there, went from the primitive to the more advanced. And so we'll start out with the Anencocephalomorpha. I've got my notes, I've written in the margin, not required with a question mark, so I don't know, we may not require you to know this one, but I didn't think they occurred up here, and yet I think Alex in the last year or two, or a couple years ago, did catch a couple out by, actually they were at those garden plots by Yunker's Farm, just up here, just to the north. He was out there, he and Vera were, had garden plots out there. They were working their garden. And these are called gnat bugs because sometimes, I've never seen a nice swarm of them, but they'll fly up in a swarm. And you know how you see the little gnats, mm-hmm. little flies in a flying swarm. These things sometimes do the same thing. And so I've caught a couple, one or two sweeping, but they were way down south, down in Florida or something. So, but I was kind of surprised to find out. We both did kind of, were surprised to find them occurring up here. I think he knows what species it is. I know we were trying to work on that, that there's another, there's a common one throughout the whole eastern U.S., and then there's some rare ones, including one that was described and only known from Iowa. And I think we were a little bit worried it could be the Iowa one up here, but I think we decided it's probably the common eastern thing. Anyway, these are called, also called the unique headed bugs. Aneco means unique. Of course, cephala means head. So literally, they are the unique headed bugs. And they do have kind of a distinctive head, that there's kind of lobes. The head is all the way from here, going all the way back to here. So you can see there's several lobes and the way the eyes bulge out. It just has kind of an odd look to its head. At one time, they thought these things were closely related to the Regiveidae. In fact, they were probably lumped in or a family placed near the Regiveidae. Now they've decided that they think these are relatively primitive and probably are near the ancestral group for the whole rest of the Hemiptera. These have four-segmented beaks, or the rostrum's four-segmented. Again, when we get to the Regiveidae later on, they only have three-segmented beaks. When we get to the Regiveidae, we'll also see that on their prosternum, they've got a kind of a groove with little striations going across, and the tip of the beak actually fits in that. These don't have that. So there's no groove on the prosternum like the Regiveidae have. Like I said, the head is long, constricted behind the eyes, and swollen between the two constrictions. The ocelli are usually on the hind lobe. These kind of have a little comb-like structure on the tibia. It'd be right in there. There's some other things that have little structures like that, but it helps them clean debris off their legs. Again, these are relatively small. They're only 2 to 5 millimeters. They can be in those swarms. There's not that many genera and species described, but it may be just because a lot of them haven't been discovered or described yet. So anyway, that's the unique headed bugs. And then we just mentioned in the Dipso Coromorpha, these are not required either. There's a couple of the families that are in the Dipso Coromorpha, the Dipso Coridae and the Schizopteridae. These, again, are little tiny things. Best bet is to catch these in leaf litter, soil samples. Although some of them do come to light. So I caught a fair number of, I believe, the Schizopterids at lights down in central Louisiana one time. I also, a number of years ago, got some samples of Hemiptera that were collected in Costa Rica. They were kind of Malaise trap samples and maybe some blacklight trap samples and stuff. And they actually had a lot of these little groups in them too. But we don't require any families. You should just should be aware of the Dipsocoromorpha are small, rare things. Although it seems like they're gaining a little more attention. There's a woman, Christiane Wyrock, runs a lab out of the University of California, Riverside. And she mainly, for a long time, was more of a myriad plant bug person. And then she did a lot of stuff with Regevillids. And now lately she's got students and that are doing a lot of nice work on some of these small groups, the Dipsochoridae and the Schizopteridae. I've sent some of my stuff to her and that. So anyway, enough said about those. Now we'll get into some families that should be more familiar to you. We go into the Nepomorpha. These are the aquatic groups. Dylan likes the Bellostomatids.
Oh, yeah.
I was planning to dissect them last year and then found out that it was a bit late.
Yeah. Anyway, the Nepomorpha, these are the aquatic bugs. There's a few families that are shore inhabiting that are still in the Nepomorpha, things like toad bugs and that. And there's another family called the Octeridae. So they're not all completely under the water, but they all of them still have those short antennae, the cryptic, more short antennae that's hidden under the head. Most of these groups are predatory, and we'll see that the water boatmen, the Corixidae, feed more on algae and that, but most of these groups are predatory. And the first family we'll talk about is the Nepidae. These are commonly called water scorpions, mostly because of the one you see on your handout to the far left. It does look a little bit like a scorpion. But there are some forms that are broader and wider that you see on the right-hand half of this. These are interesting. You notice at the posterior end of the body, they've got these long tube-like structures. And these are the cerci, but they have evolved to form a long breathing tube. So they can be underwater, and they'll stick this up out of the water, almost like snorkeling or something. And so they can breathe while they're under the water through these long tubes, breathing tubes. This family, they do not have ocelli. A lot of times you can see the front legs are modified for grabbing prey, so they have raptorial front legs. These are really not good swimmers. You don't see the other legs aren't really adapted for swimming. In fact, I've been out fishing, and normally these things would be around the shoreline or around vegetation, holding on to things where they would blend in. A lot of times upside down with that breathing tube sticking out. But I've been out fishing out in the middle of a lake, and there might have been a storm or something that got dislodged, and you can see them. They're trying to swim, and boy, they just can't hardly get through the water. It's just so. There are kind of two basic body shapes. The species that you're more likely to catch is what we see over here in the left. This is Rhinotra, the genus Rhinotra. I think we only have one species up here. It's Rhinotra fusca. But it's the one we catch them like there at Moorhead Science Center, getting up underneath the those the vegetation hanging over the water where I told you is a good place. We've caught these nepids up in there. There are some that are more broad, like you see in the other half, the genus Charicta and the genus Nepa. Let's see, what do I got? Nepa apiculata has been recorded from Mirror Pool. So that larger one there towards the right. Charicta, I think, believe has been collected out in the western part of the state. So yeah, it's a southern, southwestern ones. Sometimes these can fly, but they rarely do. These also can deliver a painful bite, just like the bellostomatids.
Oh, toe biters.
Yeah, but fortunately their beaks are really short, and so unless you handle them up by their head, they're not going to be able to bite you. So I've never worried about grabbing hold of these things. I just grab them and just make sure you're not grabbing them up near the head. Like I said, they're usually found in still water where they cling to sticks and underwater vegetation, waiting for insects or small animals to grab to eat. So, and the next family is the Bellostomatidae, which are called the giant water bugs. Which is interesting because the species we're familiar with are quite large. But I have some species that I collected in South America that are just real small little things. There's some in the tropics that are huge too. So they really range in size. Now, rather than having those breathing tubes like we saw in the nepids, they have a couple little... just a couple little structures at the posterior end called air straps. So abdomen with short caudal filaments, sometimes called air straps or air siphons. These are not formed into a tube, but they simply transfer air to the subhemelytral air store by a channel formed by CD. So these things kind of store a bubble of air under their wings. And they'll go to the surface of the water, and those air straps they can use to break through the water tension or the surface of the water. And then air will funnel. There's hairs on these that'll funnel the air up into the under their hemelytra. And then they can go underwater and breathe for quite some time using that air that they stored under their wings. The front legs are still kind of raptorial, built to catch prey. But now the hind legs, especially the other legs, are adapted for swimming. They are natatorial. What characterizes a natatorial leg is they'll be somewhat flattened, kind of oar-like, and oftentimes they'll have a long fringe of hairs that help move the water or catch the water to push through the water with. The family you're most likely to confuse these with, there's another family called the Nocoridae that we'll get to in a little bit. But these, you will notice, have lots of longitudinal veins. Now, they're not real dark and distinct, but you can see them. So, but the wings will have lots of longitudinal veins. Also, if you look at the contour of the head, notice that the eyes kind of bulge out. So you'll have the pair of eyes and then the front of the head goes up. And so if you just like draw around the edge of the head, it's like a trilobe. When we get to the Nocoridae, the eyes just blend in nicely with the rest of the head. So it's just a kind of a half circle, nice and round. So, and the Nocorids, they don't have these air straps. The problem is that when Bellostomatids die, a lot of times those air straps kind of go up under the wings, so they're not always real obvious. So, these sometimes can emit a foul odor. Again, they can deliver a painful bite. Dylan likes to call them the toe biters.
A lot of people around my area call them.
Yeah. And these do fly around a lot at night. You end up finding them, we've talked about before, in parking lots under street lights. But they'll fly around the way they it's how they disperse. But then they'll try to find bodies of water. There has been times where there are problems where they'll find people's swimming pools. And it's maybe not one of the things you want to be out swimming with you, something that can bite pretty well. Again, they are very good swimmers. In fact, the smaller species, these that are like in Bellostoma and Abetus over to the right, I've not had too much trouble catching those using like an aquatic net. But you almost never catch the larger, the Lethoceras that's over there on the left-hand side with an aquatic net, because they're just such good swimmers. They can dodge your net. We have, when I was down in Louisiana, we were trying to catch those bigger ones, and we've got fish seines, the big nets, and two of us would walk through an area of water, each holding an end of that net, and I've caught some of the big Lethoceras with the big fishing seine nets. So, again, because they fly and end up at lights, sometimes some of them are called electric light bugs. And then the last thing, well, a couple things still. Some of the smaller species, like in Bellostoma and Abetus, they have the habit where the females will lay their eggs on the backs of the males. And so that's what you see there in the handout at the bottom center, is a male with the eggs laid on its backs. And it helps, he can kind of protect them. He also keeps the water moving over them so they get well oxygenated that way, and they won't get mold or fungi as much in that. So, I guess the last thing I'll mention, that in some areas of the world, these are often eaten by humans. Down in Mexico, they eat Bellostomatids. Out down in the southeastern Asia, Vietnam, Thailand, and that, you can find them out on the marketplace. Big bowls of Bellostomatids for food. So, next family, keep going here a little bit. It'd be nice if we could get through the Nepomorpha, but I don't know. Next family I'll talk about is the Charyxidae. These are called the water boatmen. These have the front tarsi one segmented and highly modified. You can see there in the handout in the middle, this is the highly modified front tarsi. It's kind of a scoop-like structure with these long hairs on it. It's used to move through the water and to gather algae or plankton, small organisms, which it can then bring up to its mouth to feed on. And that structure is called a pala, P-A-L-A. This is the Charyxidae, yep. Sometimes they also can stridulate. They'll rub their front leg kind of against the side of their head or the beak. The beak is also now highly modified. It doesn't look like a beak anymore. It's just kind of like a one-segmented, really broad structure. And like I said, they feed more on like algae. They'll bring the algae with that pala up to their mouth and feed on it. So it's still kind of the sucking mouth parts, but it's a big, broad, cone-shaped structure now. What you're most likely to confuse these with is the back swimmers, the Notonectidae, which to me, they look so much different. But these, there's a tendency for these, I mean, they have this palette that the notenectids don't have, but the patterns on these, they're almost always like light and dark striped going across the backs. These also, the wings are held more flat over their backs. The notenectids, it's much more roof-like. So, again, to me, they're good differences, but that still seems to be a problem that sometimes we confuse the Corixidae with the notenectidae. They have what they call a stridule back on the posterior part of the body, but it's kind of a misnomer. That's used more for mating, that it helps hold the female in mating. These also have sub-elytral air stores, so they'll get bubble up under the wings. These usually are in, again, more still areas. Like I said, in general, aquatic insects, if they're relying on oxygen actually in the water, or so they have gills and things like that, you'll find them in fast-moving riffle areas where the oxygen levels are higher. Things that are relying on atmospheric oxygen, where they go to the surface more, you tend to find them more in the still pools and quieter parts of the water. They don't need to have that high levels of oxygen in the water. So, again, eggs are laid on aquatic plants. Sometimes they can be quite numerous. Again, in Mexico, the people will gather Corixid eggs and the Corixids themselves, and again, grind it up into flour and that sort of stuff for consumption. So they'll eat Corixids and the Corixid eggs. These come to lights readily. I catch them in my backyard when I run lights all the time.
Catching my Concordia, very easy.
Yeah. They're often active during the wintertime. Fishermen will talk about how they can see them swimming under the ice during the wintertime. They are an important part of the food chain. A lot of things eat these things. One of my past students, a student named Paul Tinarella, kind of worked on Corixidae, and he published a really nice, it's a softbound, ring-bound book on the Corixidae of Minnesota. He'd started work, he had done his undergraduate work at St. Cloud, so he was kind of more interested in the Minnesota fauna. But he was working on the Corixidae of North Dakota, too, that we were going to publish, but he's kind of gotten out of systematics now. I think he teaches high school down in the cities and that. But we've got a wonderful book on the Corixidae of Minnesota with color plates of all the species in that. It's a really nice thing. So anyway, I've taken us 5 minutes over, and we're still got a little ways to go before we're done with the Nepomorpha even. So I think rather than push it, we'll just stop there for today and pick up with after the Corixidae tomorrow. Guess it'll be Thursday.
So do not mix these up. Mix Corixidae up with the
Notenectidae.
Notenectidae.
The back swimmers. Yeah. Like I said, you get the two of them out side by side.
Yeah, they
you say,
do.
Oh, they're
they
quite
do
different.
Look very different.
Yeah. So, but Ed, still, it's just from past experience. People, students sometimes confuse the two, but. Behavior-wise, they're quite different, too. Like I said, the back swimmers. They're called back swimmers because they rest and swim on their backs.
Yeah. So. It's real fun to... In my experience, it's been fun to watch them, you know, on the tennis courts just try to swim in seconds.
Yep. So...
And finally flip on their back and you flip on the front and be like, well, this isn't working. I'm just going to sit here for a bit.
Notenectidae also have the balas on the. Do they have like a similar body plan?
Well, like I said, these are more look flat on the backs, And these are, and the notonectids are more roof-like. Also, notonectids actually have kind of a ridge going down. We'll see when we get to those. We call it a ventral keel. But they have a ridge on the underneath side of the abdomen that these don't have also. You know, the pictures may not do them justice on the flatness or roof-like, but... But you notice they don't have the transverse light and dark lines like the Corixids do. They'll have some dark bands or white and dark bands on them, but it's not the nice transverse little stripes.
You have any in your collection, dude?
Okay. I'm going to see if I can put one. I will stop the lecture.